last week, where we looked at the Upanishads and the ascetic traditions and the Nautsa traditions, and we're now moving on to look at the beginnings of theism in India, and the rise of the different theistic traditions. Now, between 500 BC and the first millennium BC, you get the growth of the worship of particular deities, particularly Shiva and Vishnu and the goddess, and we're going to be looking at these developments. And you get the idea of devotion, bhakti, to these gods taking the place of sacrifice, yajna, that we looked at a couple of weeks ago. And the fundamental religious act becomes puja. Puja is making an offering to a deity and receiving a blessing. And that becomes a fundamental worshipful act. And that can become very elaborated or very simple. So, as it says in the Gita, if you can just offer a flower to Krishna, and that's sufficient. Or you can have a very ornate and elaborate puja over a long period of time. So bhakti, devotion to a personal god, Bhagavat, or a goddess, Bhagavati, takes the place of sacrificial ritual. So so you get the Bhagavad Gita, the song of the Lord. Bhagavat simply means God, really. Bhagavan, the Lord. Bhagavan in a nominative singular for the Sanskritists amongst you. So the Bhagavat, one who possesses abundance, Bhaga. Or the Bhagavati, the goddess who possesses abundance. Now, you get various historical developments occurring during this period of time. You get a process called Sanskritization occurring, whereby the dominant elites, the intellectual elites, the Brahmins, absorb within their traditions, local traditions, but probably in vernacular languages. So various gods like Krishna, for example, was a local deity who gets absorbed into the Brahmanical pantheon, if you like, and gets associated with the large Hindu gods of Vishnu, Narayana, as we'll see. And Sheldon Pollock has called this growth of Sanskrit, this dominance of Sanskrit, the Sanskrit cosmopolis. And it spread from right the way from what is now Afghanistan, right the way through to Southeast Asia. It was a vast area of where Sanskrit would have been the learned language, not the lingua franca, not the popular language, but the learned language of the educated elites who would be able to converse with each other, right the way from Taxila, right the way through to the Khmer kingdoms, up to about the 11th century. And you get a vast spread of Sanskrit knowledge and Sanskrit texts. So texts which were composed, and they spread very quickly, so texts which were composed in Kashmir spread to the south within 100 years, and there's some texts which we know were composed in the south, which were exist in Nepal within 30 years. So there's a lot of interchange, and these texts travel really quite quickly, considering the technology of the time and so on. Now, one of the features of this is that the assimilation of the ascetic ideal that we looked at last week into high-caste householder ideology. So we've seen this in the Bhagavad Gita, and we'll look at this again next week, where the Bhagavad Gita tries to reconcile this idea of renunciation, which was the realm of the renouncers, the world renouncers, with the householder's life. So the household, the high caste householder, can fulfill the arthas, the purush arthas, the obligations of duty, dharma, pleasure, karma, and wealth, artha. But he can also now become liberated, achieve moksha. So you, the ideal of the renouncer is assimilated into the householder ideology. So you don't have to give up action the way the renouncers did, which is a very old, we saw as a very ancient kind of pedigree within India, the idea of giving up action. So in Jainism you have the renouncers who give up action because action keeps you bound in the world. And the Gita says, you don't give up action, you act in the world, do your duty, but you give up the results of action, you give up the fruits of your action to God, to Krishna. So you don't have to, you're not responsible in a sense. If you're detached from your actions and you give up the fruits of your actions to Krishna, then you've done your duty, you've fulfilled your obligation, your dharma, but you've also achieving a detached state conducive to liberation. That's in this life or in some future life. So you get both together with the Bhagavad Gita, renunciation and doing your duty as a person in the world. And you also get the assimilation of low caste possession cards. Also, yeah, sorry, we haven't looked at that. I think we might look at that. We're not going to look at that in this course, but you get also low caste possession cults assimilating these higher caste ascetic ideals into them as well, particularly in Kerala, in the Tayan traditions of Kerala, for example. We won't look at that for today. And the other historical development are the segmentary states. So Hinduism, I think I've mentioned this before, but the Indian kingdoms have, it's not like a kingdom, like the Roman Empire or something like that. You've got a king who governs a certain area, and you've got these small tribal kingdoms or tribal areas with a local chieftain who then pays ritual homage to a higher king, who in turn pays ritual homage to a higher king, to this big king at the top. Now he receives homage and taxes. So for example, in the Vijayanagara Empire, centred at Hampi, the king would once a year at the Durga Puja sit on a big tower and receive homage from all these people who would come and give him elephants and possessions and so on. So he would take tax from these lower kingdoms, and in return he would protect them from other kings. And the king at the top of this tower was said to receive the energy, the shakti of Durga into him on this ritual occasion. So the king becomes an embodiment of the goddess, of shakti, of the energy, the power of the goddess goes into him. And that was enacted on this ritual occasion in the Vijayanagara Empire at Hampi. As an example. And Bert Stein has written on this, a peasant about feudalism in South Asia. Do anyone remember the title of that book? Bert and Stein. Peasant State and Society. It's written about the segmentary Hindu state. And patronage, of course, the Brahmins were vying for patronage. So lots of these gods that came to the fore because of royal patronage. And different groups of Brahmins were rivals with each other for royal patronage. Shaivism particularly became dominant in South India, and the kings were patrons of Shaiva cults and Shaiva Brahmins because of the connection with power. So along with the historical development of the segmentary Hindu state and patronage of these different deities, you get these narrative traditions developing, particularly the epics and the Puranas, which I'm going to be speaking of. Now, there is a problem of historiography, the writing about history in South Asia. But, I mean, the texts are not dated, and there's a big problem about how you date this material. And there's No. Well, there is some, but there's very little historiography in South Asia. There's very little writing about history. I mean, they developed linguistics, they developed science of language, they developed mathematics, they developed geometry, developed astronomy, developed medicine to some extent. But there's no science of history that develops. And you get some texts such as Kalhana's Annals of the Kings of Kashmir, but that's an exception, and there's very, very little historiography. So what we know about history has to come from, we have to glean it from texts like the Epics and Puranas, the indigenous narratives, and also from archaeological and epigraphic evidence as well. So there's a problem with the lack of historiography in South Asia. And we get a strong development of what we would call mythical narratives. Now, I think one of the problems, I mean, in Greece you get Democritus. There is no Indian Democritus for whatever reason that is. You get a distinction between Logos and Muthos, where Logos is linked with history, the writing of history, and Muthos is linked with narrative and fable and imagination. That distinction was not clearly... You do get a distinction in India, but it wasn't formalised in that way, the way it was in Greece. I think that's one reason why you don't get historiography. But I mean, you can pick me up on that. Chris Minkowski has written on this and is doing some work on the historiography in India. But you do get a development in these other kinds of narratives, particularly the epics and Puranas. And in those epics and Puranas, you get the rise of these deities, Vishnu, Shiva, and the goddess, particularly important. And they still have great contemporary relevance. So there are some people argue that these are distinct religions. The religions of Vishnu, Shiva, and the goddess are almost like distinct religions. And indeed, I think there's truth to that. So the followers of Vishnu are called Vaishnavas, the followers of Shiva are called Shaivas, and the followers of the goddess are called Shaktas. And these traditions are still very much with us today. Now, a lot of this material was established during the Gupta reign. The Guptas ruled from about 320 to 500 CE. And what we see as Hinduism today begins to be formulated during this period, what we understand by modern Hinduism. I'm going to talk about the Puranas in a minute. Yeah, so the Puranic material particularly develops during the Gupta period. Now the epics, let's look at the epics now. The epics form the largest literary body in the world. The Mahabharata, these two great epics, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. The Mahabharata contains about 75,000 verses, and the Ramayana about 20,000. And they developed between the 5th century BCE and the 4th century CE. They're vast, rambling epics. And they're committed to writing around the 1st century CE. And they reflect the concerns of... Sorry, the Kshatriya is not wrong there. Kshatriya aristocracy. The Mahabharata, and they're re-performed and reenacted over and over again, and they're still highly relevant today. And they were on TV 20 years ago, televised, and TV became a shrine where Mahabharata was playing. And also instrumental in the politicization of Hinduism in the last 20 years or so, Mahabharata, and indeed the Ramayana. And we'll look at that presently. So these texts reflect the concerns of a Kshatriya aristocracy rather than the Brahmins. And in the epics, you do get the older pattern of Vedic ritual, but that gradually becomes replaced by this devotion to particular gods. In the earlier sections of the text, you get an emphasis on heaven, svarga, rather than samsara and moksha, reincarnation and liberation. And that bears witness to the way the transformation or new elements coming into the Hindu tradition. So, if you remember the old Vedic worldview of the Pitriloka and the Pretaloka, how when you die you go into the Pretaloka and then after 9-10 months you go into the Pitri, you become Pitri, and then you go into the realm of the all gods. Do you remember that? We looked at a few weeks ago. And then the Upanishads tried to reconcile this with, you know, you come back down to earth as rain and so on. Now, so the Pitriloka gets associated with Svarga, heaven, and you get an emphasis on, that model still exists in the early epics. And it begins to get replaced by this idea of samsara and moksha, that actually the soul doesn't go through this process, but actually gets reborn, comes back into the world. And this goal of moksha, liberation, comes to replace heaven. Now that the svarga and moksha, they're often collided, even today in popular imagination. So in Kerala we asked our assistant about what happens when you die, and he said you go to heaven, and he used the word moksha for heaven. Svarga and moksha were just the same for him, didn't make any difference, distinction between them. So at a popular level, moksha and svarga were often conflated. But technically they're quite distinct. So you go to svarga, and then you get reborn from heaven until you achieve moksha, liberation. Now the epics bear witness to the rise of these deities, Vishnu, Shiva, and also Brahma. But Brahma falls out of the popular imagination fairly quickly. And there's also references to pilgrimages, to tirthas, to these crossing places, to these centres, Ayodhya and places like this. And there's lots of stories of sages, forest hermits, the Vanaprastas, rather than renounces. You don't get that many renounces in the epics, but you get these sages who live in the forest with their wife performing religious rituals.
Could you put back the earlier one, please?
Yes. The Ramayana and that's the Mahabharata, yeah. So, and then the Mahabharata, let's look at this. This was traditionally ascribed to the sage Vyasa. Vyasa just means the arranger, so he was supposed to be the redactor. But, of course, it was composed over many hundreds of years. It was it grew and grew and grew. And the actual story is a struggle for control of the Kuru kingdom between two sets of cousins, the five Pandavas, the sons of Pandu, and the 100 Kauravas. And the basic story is that there's a dice match. Yudhishthira, the eldest of the Pandavas, loses the kingdom in a dice match to the Kauravas. So he loses at the dice and he forfeits the whole kingdom to them. And as a result of which, he has to go to exile for 12 years with his brothers and return and live incognito in society for 1 year. And then the Kauravas say, we'll give you the kingdom back, but they don't. So there's a war, there's a battle over... Oh yeah, five brothers with their wife Draupadi. They have a common wife, Draupadi. Yeah, they have to come back. And after the return, the Kauravas refuse to give the kingdom back, and war follows. And the Bhagavad Gita that we're going to look at next time reflects Arjuna's concern. I'm sure you know the story. He said, why should I fight in this war? and I've been keeping killing my cousins who I've grown up with, and so on. And Krishna persuades him to fight in war because it's his dharma as a warrior, it's his swadharma, his duty as a warrior to fight. And it's interesting that Bhagavad Gita was Gandhi's favourite book. Gandhi was such a pacifist, of course, but the Gita itself it advocates the notion of a just war. So it's interesting. Now, the battle itself lasts over 18 days and occupies the middle part of the epic, which is 18 books. So it's a vast, rambling text, this. And then there's a text, the lamentations of the women after the battle. And then there are two books about Bhishma's advice to Yudhishthira when he's dying, and various events in the Pandavas' lives, to the end of the Pandavas' lives. And there's a famous story of Yudhishthira when he's going to heaven, he's walking to heaven with a dog, and the dog is Bhakta, is devoted to him. But when he gets to heaven, they won't let him in because he's got a dog, and because that must be moving. So he said, well, I don't want to go if you don't let my dog in. And then the dog actually turns out to be an incarnation of Dharma, the god Dharma, virtue, duty. And then he eventually goes into heaven. And when he goes into heaven, he sees all the Kauravas there enjoying themselves. And he's so shocked to see his enemies there in heaven. But they did their duty, they did their Dharma, so they're in heaven too. It's a sad story in the book. It's a greatly pessimistic story, I always think of Mahabharata. It portrays a deep pessimism, I think, about the world. But it's a wonderful story, a wonderful epic, and there's lots of sub-stories within it, like the story of Nala. If any of you are doing Sanskrit, then you'll be probably reading the story of Nala, who again comes to grief because of his addicted, his akshapriya, his beloved of dice, he loves gambling, like Yudhishthira. So anyway, the Ramayana is ascribed to Valmiki, and it's a story of Rama. And Rama is banished to the forest by his father through the machinations of his stepmother. And she gets the father to agree to anything she wants, and she wants Rama to be banished, and so he agrees to that. And Rama, being an obedient son, does what his father's bidding. So he goes off to the forest with his wife Sita. And then Sita is abducted by Ravana, the demon, the king of the Rakshasas, who lives in Sri Lanka. And the story is that the finding of Sita with the help of the monkey Hanuman. For those who, the Sanskrit is a monkey, the Hanuman is a nominative singular, Hanumat, he who possesses a jaw, the one with a jaw, Hanuman, who is devoted to Rama. Then there's a big battle, the battle for Lanka, and there's his victorious return to Ayodhya. And the main theme in this text, as in the Mahabharata, is the importance of Dharma. Dharma, virtue and duty. The centrality of Dharma. So Rama obeys his father, and then there's a Sita is to prove her purity, steps into a fire. I can't remember the precise details of how the fire arose. It was a magical fire. Does anyone remember?
I remember the god of earth proved her purity.
Yeah, she burns herself in the fire. She doesn't burn because...
Burn. And then the god of the earth...
Yeah, you know it better than me. The god of the earth comes up or something. Yeah, I don't remember the precise details. Her purity is established in this trial by fire. And there are lots of later retellings and developments of the story. There's the Adhyatma Ramayana, which is a kind of a spin, a Advaita Vedanta spin on it. There's Tulsidas's Ramacharitmanasa, the Yoga Vashishta, and the Tamil version, Iramavataram. Now, the doctrine in these texts is about incarnations of God Vishnu. And the Avatara doctrine emerges later on, really. Now, the Ramayana does not seem to know the concept of the avatara, but although the Mahabharata does. It doesn't seem to be in the Ramayana. And there are later developments. The Harivamsha develops a Krishna story, and then you get the Puranas developing the story as well of Krishna. But the idea is that Rama becomes known not in the text itself, but in later tradition as an incarnation of Vishnu, as the heroic warrior. So Rama becomes, particularly in modern Hinduism, becomes a model of heroism and devotion and dedication to his dharma and to his kingdom. And the Hindu right, the BJP and the VHP and the RSS and these other organisations, Shiv Sena, were very fond of Rama as a great figure of as a model, a heroic model of the martial Hindu. The other incarnations that you get are the other 10 avatars in like the boar who raises the earth. Is identified with Brahma originally and only later with Vishnu, and the fish, the matsya that saves Manu from a flood, is likewise identified with Brahma and later becomes identified with Vishnu. But the epics particularly reflect the rise of Vaishnavism. Vaishnavism is the main tradition, if you like, of the two epics. The avatars or manifestations or emanations of Vishnu are important, come to be important later on. There's a god called Narayana, and Vishnu gets fused with Narayana. And you get this idea of, this is Sanskritization really, Vishnu and Narayana were distinct gods, but they get fused together in the epics. And then further, there's Krishna gets identified with Vishnu and Narayana in the course of the story as well. And there's a section of the text called the Narayaniya about the worship of Narayana, who gives grace to those who are single-mindedly devoted to him. And Narayana explains that Vasudeva, which is another name for Krishna, the son of Vasudeva, is the inner controller of everyone. So there's an assimilation of all these gods into each other. Vishnu gets identified with Narayana, and Krishna gets, as Vasudeva gets identified with Narayana. So Narayana is the creator, maintainer, and destroyer of the universe, and Krishna is his form as the inner controller of everyone, the heart of all beings, the Antaryami. And in that text, you get the early development of a tradition called the Pancharatra, which we'll be looking at our next term. The five-night sacrifice. It's the early form of Vaishnavism. And another section, the Moksha Parvan of the Mahabharata, contains philosophical speculation, particularly of Samkhya and Yoga. Samkhya is the dualist system of philosophy, if you remember, of the in which the soul, or the spirit, the Purusha, is quite distinct from matter, from Prakriti. And the goal of life is to separate the spirit from matter. Now that doctrine is very pervasive in this section of the text, and it's very important, as we'll see next week in the Bhagavad Gita. We'll look at the text next week, and we'll look at Samkhya and Yoga more closely there as well. Now the Puranas, slightly later than the epics. And the Purana means ancient, so the ancient texts composed after the epics, and there were traditionally 18, but there are many more Puranas. 18 is a magical number, of course. And they were originally recited by bards, suttas, Brahmanical bards, and they were established during the Gupta reign, and they bear witness to the rise of the gods Vishnu, Shiva, and the goddess, and other deities such as Agni, Skanda, Ganesha, Brahma. So the Agni Purana, Skanda Purana. In fact, the Skanda Purana, there's a project based in Holland on the Skanda Purana, which has been recently critically edited and translated. It's one of the few texts to have been to, for that treatment to have been done on it. So the problem is a great body of rambling again text, which we know, which haven't been sufficiently studied really. So it's a great forest. Wendy Donig has done work on the Puranas, and there's this project to establish a critical edition of the Skanda Purana. And we have a project on the Bhagavata Purana OCHS, which is beginning to develop, but the study of these texts is still in its infancy. Now, the Puranas show how popular religion is assimilated by the Brahmins who compose the texts. So these Puranas are good examples of Sanskritization, whereby local traditions are assimilated and absorbed into the Brahmanical worldview. And they're not random throwings together of different ideas. They're crafted texts. The Puranas are consciously constructed and formed over quite long periods of time, but nevertheless, I think we have to see them as worldviews, as ideologies, if you like, which are being propagated by certain groups of people. And they deal with five topics traditionally: the creation of the universe, the destruction of the universe, and then its recreation again, over and over again. The genealogies of the gods and the sages, the reigns of mythic progenitors of humankind called the Manus, 14 Manus, and the history of the solar and lunar dynasties of kings. And physical kings will try to trace their lineage to the sun and the moon, to these lunar and solar dynasties. Now, the Vishnu Purana, for example, was composed about the 4th century CE, and it presents a Vaishnava worldview. It's a very crafted text which presents a Vaishnava worldview. And in the text, it has the mythology of Vishnu. Vishnu wakes up, he becomes Brahma, he creates the universe, he sustains it and destroys it as Rudra, who's a form of Shiva. And then he goes back to sleep on the cosmic snake Shesha. You've probably seen representations of Shiva lying on the ocean, lying on a snake who is lying on this cosmic ocean. And then he opens his eyes, and out from his navel comes a lotus. Out from the lotus comes the god Brahma. Brahma creates the universe, and then he destroys it, reabsorbs it back into himself, and goes back to sleep. And this story happens over and over again. And this is Krishna's, or Vishnu's, lila, his play. Why does God create the universe and destroy it? He does it from lila, through play, over and over again. So it's like, what is play? Play is purposeless action, action for its own sake rather than for the sake of something else. So in this worldview, the universe has no meaning other than the play of God. It's God creates the universe and destroys it over and over again. And it also contains a story of Prahlada. Prahlada was a devotee of Vishnu, but his wicked uncle Hiranyakashipu wouldn't allow him to worship Vishnu, and so Vishnu. Now, Hiranyakashipu was a demon who couldn't be destroyed by day or by night, by a human or an animal, inside a house or outside a house. So what did Vishnu do? He incarnated in a pillar of the house, which is neither inside the house nor outside the house, bursts out of the pillar in the form of a half man, half lion, neither animal nor human, at twilight, between night and day, and destroys Hiranyakashipu, tears out the entrails of Hiranyakashipu, who is then liberated, of course, having been killed by Vishnu. And so Prahlada is then free to worship Vishnu. So that's the Vishnu Purana. There's another text that comes after that, which we'll be looking at, not next week, perhaps. No, I don't think we'll look at this time, but the Bhagavata Purana, which is an extremely popular Purana focused on the worship of Krishna, the rise of Krishna worship. It's probably quite late, probably about the 10th or 11th century, maybe a bit earlier, which follows on the Vishnu Purana. Now, the Brahmins who followed the Smritis, the law books, which I mentioned last week, and also the Puranas, were called Smritis or Puranas. The Smritis because they followed Smriti, and Puranas because they were Puranas. And you get smarters of the Vaishnava smarters and Shaiva smarters, but you also get smarters who worshipped five deities in the home, and the mystic worship of five deities in five shrines. And this is called the Panchayatana Puja, which became important during this period. And the five gods are Vishnu, Shiva, Ganesh, Surya, the sun, and Devi, the goddess, in the form of Durga. And later worship of distinct deities comes to the fore. So, the smarters are still in existence and full of And with the collapse of the Guptas, you get the rise of independent kingdoms. After the collapse of the Guptas, you get these independent kingdoms springing up all over the place. In the 7th century, the Chalukyas in the central and western Deccan, the Pallavas in the southeast. From about 900 to 1200, these kingdoms are replaced by the Pandyas in the far south, the Cholas in the Tamil region, Rashtrakutas replacing the Chalukyas, and so on. And each of these developed urban centres. So you get this textual development, and you also get the rise of these urban centres which have big temples which govern the region. And these big urban centres are administrative centres and religious centres at the same time. So the ritual as well as commercial and administrative centres. And the authority of the king was established through his Brahmanic legitimation in the temple. So the king invested in these large temples and the Brahmins who govern them. And these temples bear witness to these main deities, Vishnu, Shiva, and Devi. And from the 11th to 13th century, these large temple complexes were built as centres of regional kingdom. So there's lots of them. There's Jagannath in Puri, for example, the great temple to the Lord of the Universe, to Vishnu in the form of Jagannatha. Which is a great centre of pilgrimage. Chidambaram in the south for the Shaiva worship of Shiva, Nataraja, the dancing form of Shiva in the south. The Raja Rajesh for a temple in Tanjavur. All these are great Chola, temples for the great Chola kings. The earliest temple, about the 7th century, I think, is Mahabalipuram, which is carved out of the rock Shiva temple there. The Padmanabha Swami temple in Tiruvannathapuram in Trivandrum, a great Vishnu temple constructed during this period. That's the Gopuram of the temple there, the gateway, the and oh dear. There's the Brihadeshwara temple, and the patron Raja Raja I, the Chola king, was consecrated this temple in 1011. And sorry about the quality of these photographs. But that, again, the Gopuram there, and you can see the tower, the shikha, one of the temples in there. And surrounding the temples are these Dwarapalas, the protectors of the temple. And here's Nandin. Now, originally, Nandi becomes, in later Shaivism, becomes the bull that Shiva rides on. But originally, he was this ferocious protector of the temple. That's Tanjavur. And this is the Shiva Linga in Tanjavur, still worshipped. I mean, 10th, 11th century Shiva Linga, still functioning in use. And here we have a priest offering, making offerings to the Shiva Linga. So you can see the size of it compared to the figure there. There's a massive, massive Shiva Linga. All of these temples, these big Chola temples, contain the Shiva Linga, with the exception of Chidambaram, which has the dancing Shiva. And here's the Raja Rajeshwara temple at Tanjavur, whose patron is Raja Raja I. It's a bit like a mountain. So you get the Garbhagriha, the womb room, right in the centre where the sacred image is kept. The Shiva Linga in this case. And often these temples are covered in carvings. This is Gangai Konda Cholapuram, another wonderful temple to visit in South India, which was built by Rajendra I. And he was the Chola king who is said to have brought the Ganges from the Ganges to South India in a pot. Again, a wonderful temple with nothing. So, I mean, originally it was a middle of a big city, but you go there now, it's just a temple in a small village, and nothing there anymore, with the forest and all about it. And again, you've got the Dwara Palas here at the door. Nandin, and I forget the name of the other one. I'm sorry. And here we have the carvings on the outside. You see the incredibly ornate and elaborate carvings. And as you go into the temple, the carvings get less and less. So until you reach the centre of the temple, it's still some hardly any carvings there at all, really. But it's the idea that externally there's such a lot going on, there's hardly any part of the temple's left uncarved. Here's forms of Shiva on the side of the temple. Here's Adharanarishvara, half Shiva, half goddess. And there's the dancing Shiva, dancing on the dwarf, the Apasmara, dancing on the dwarf of ignorance with his flame which destroys the universe, and his gesture of fear not, although I destroy the universe, don't be afraid. He's also creating the universe as well, and he has this serene smile, and he's laughing here, Hasta. And he's dancing on this dwarf, the dwarf of ignorance. And there's a dancing goddess beneath him. And then we get to Chidambaram. Chidambaram on the coast was a great Shaiva centre, which attracted many Shaiva theologians. It's the one centre just here where you have the dancing Shiva, the image of the dancing Shiva, and you get this magnificent tank for purification. Most Hindu temples have a tank, and so people will go and bathe in the tank for purification and then do puja to the Nataraja. And it's a vast area, and you get these big gopurams, four gopurams at either side. And the town radiates out from the centre of the temple. And it was a great Shaiva centre of theology as well as an administrative centre. So you get theologians coming down from Agora Shiva, for example, a very famous 11th century Shaiva Siddhanta theologian, comes down from Bengal and writes his treatises here in Chidambaram. Bhojadeva, the great Shaiva theologian, writes in Chidambaram. Umapati, 12th century theologian, writes in Chidambaram. And you get, it's interesting, because in Chidambaram you get a fusion of both the Sanskrit learning and Tamil tradition as well. It gets fused together in the Shaiva Siddhanta tradition. And there's a Chidambaram Gopuram. These great figures are protecting deities as well. Oh, there's a Chidambaram Nataraj, the dancing of Shiva, in the central shrine there. And it's famous for its dancers, the Chidambaram Temple. You've got these 108 dancers around the walls of the Chidambaram Temple. So these temples were magnificently carved and very well designed and built. And Dharasuram, the Ainavateshvara temple, he was the elephant that Indra rode on. And this is a wonderful building. 12th century. temple built by Rajaraja the First, Rajaraja the Second. So, in Dharasuram, with a Shiva linga in the centre. So most of these temples are to Shiva. Shiva was undoubtedly the most dominant deity at this time. And here you've got lots of carvings and acrobats, or dancers. I mean, they're singing and dancing and doing acrobatics. So I imagine that the worship in these temples would have been quite vibrant and lively. It would have been dancers and acrobatics performed in worship, in service of the Lord in the centre of the temple, as part of the pujas, as part of the celebrations. I don't think I'll go on to Shaiva traditions actually. So by way of sort of conclusion then, or summary, we can say that during this vast period of time, from 500 BC to about during the first millennium, you get the rise of these deities and the rise of bhakti worship of particular gods through puja, through making an offering and receiving a blessing. And these deities had textual resources supporting them. The epics and Puranas particularly focus on Vishnu. The epics, Ramayana and Mahabharata focus on Vishnu. And also the development of Puranas, the Vishnu Purana and the Bhagavata Purana, bearing witness to the development of the Vaishnava tradition and the rise of Krishna. Likewise, in the Shaiva tradition, you get the Shiva Purana and the Skanda Purana, bearing witness to the rise of the worship of Shiva, and also the rise of the worship of the goddess Durga and Kali, who we'll be looking at So along with this textual development, this explosion of textual material, we also get the development of these temple cities, these important urban centres, which are regional administrative centres as well as religious centres of pilgrimage. And you get these great deities, Vishnu, Shiva and the goddess, installed in these temples, supported by kings, and to absorb local traditions into them. A bit like as the king was the ruler of a segmentary state, if you like, so these gods were rulers of sort of segmentary states in a way, with smaller deities being absorbed into them, with the big god on the top. And again, also related to caste, so low caste deities becoming absorbed into the great tradition, into the Sanskritic cosmopolis, as emanations or incarnations of these higher gods. And then we can tell the story of the development of Vaishnavism and tell the story of the development of Shaivism, which we'll be doing in the next terms of work. We won't have time this day. So next week we're going to look at a detailed discussion of the Bhagavad Gita before going on to Indian philosophy. So any questions or points?
Yeah, a couple. You said that they used the Ramayana to justify political actions these days. So, I mean, that indicates that they must take it as some basis in history as opposed to just purely myth.
Yeah.
So they do?
Yeah. So, like, Ayodhya is a place where Ram was born.
Right.
And so there's the temple, the mosque there that was torn down by the BJP and the
Isn't that it's a Hanuman thing, the Manti King, that's literally,
well, some people, yeah, it depends on who you are, really. People in a village will might take it literally, but educated.
Okay. And at what stage in this process did the monotheism sort of get introduced? Was it after this sort of flourishing of different worship of gods?
Right from the beginning, I think monotheism gets introduced. But the idea that these other gods are emanations or manifestations of this one supreme god, Shiva or Vishnu. who gets identified with Brahman very often.
Okay.
And then you get monistic interpretations of it and theistic interpretations, if you like.
Okay, sure. Sorry, just one more question. How did it come to be that Shiva's represented as this linga instead of just as a...
an iconic... that seems to have developed over... from quite an early period, he gets identified with the linga, which is really a phallic form of Shiva. I don't know at what point or... Well, because he's power. It's power. He's a god. He's the god of. He's a powerful god. He's a god of power. And this dimension gets picked up in the tantric traditions that we'll be looking at next term. But they're all powerful, really. Well, thanks everyone. Thanks for coming. And we'll get the Bhagavad Gita next week.